Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book, In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 8.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Journey through the stories that define the artists playing Bonnaroo. Who are they? What are they? What will you see? The what? Which bands? This year, that matter.
Yay.
With Brad Steiner and Barry Corder.
Oh, the romance of electronic dance music. I feel like I'm relaxing on a boat. Lean back. This is essentially Jimmy Buffett for me.
I have a prediction.
Okay.
Right. I was listening this morning to some of the acts on the lineup.
Okay.
I think you will be pleasantly surprised. I think there are actually some acts that fit that bill more than you think.
Fit Jimmy Buffett?
Not I'm quite in. That level.
Oh, okay.
But relaxing, atmospheric, psychedelic, a lot more atmospheric than, again, we're going to talk about it during the show,
yeah.
But this future bass idea. It's not the bass drop that Bass Nectar, you know,
look,
punches you right
look,
in the chest.
Look, all I care about is
There's
if...
Some of that.
All I care about is every 10 or 20 seconds I hear... That's all I care about.
It's not as much as that. Some acts like Flume and Seven Lions and even Rez. I'm not going to predict you're going to spend a lot of time over at the other, but I have a feeling you might do a walk by.
The old man always said it takes all kinds.
That's exactly all kinds.
Right. Welcome to the What Podcast, a podcast for Bonnaroovians by Bonnaroovians. I'm Brad. That's Barry, your Bonnaroovians, taking you through EDM this week. Hopefully, we can really dissect this because as a Bonnaroo guy, EDM never really my thing. And we luckily have an EDM expert on the phone with us today.
We have threatened and been threatened to do this for 3 years,
yeah.
To go step outside of our comfort zones,
sure.
and do this. And that trip to Knoxville with Ted and Brian and Steve, you know, they said, why don't you get the guys who book the other?
Well, you
know. And Sophie from that does the experiences out in the plaza. They said, call them.
It's a star-studded lineup today. So we've got two people on the show today that curate part of your Bonnaroo experience. Sophie, who is sort of over all of the plazas and the campground experiences. And then you've got Robert, the doctor, who is over all of the electronic dance music at the other. And again, it's not something that we have paid much attention to on this show in the past 2 years, to our detriment, but also we just don't know usually what we're talking about. You
sure.
being a much bigger EDM fan than I, though.
Which is a low bar, because you're...
Right. Oh, yeah. I don't get off the ground.
No, and I've said many times, and I am serious, I really do like Bass Nectar. I like Girl Talk. There's a couple others.
I do really like Girl Talk. I mean, I don't know how you can not have fun at a Girl Talk
yeah.
show.
Yeah, it's clever. It's not just... Whatever, it's a show.
I like these guys when the samples are things that I know.
And that's the fun part.
That's the real fun part.
Oh, I know that. That's the fun part, and he's very good at it and stitches it all together into a way that makes some sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of the acts that are going to be on the lineup this year are going to fit some of that bill. They don't sound like Girl Talk, but it's music.
I got you.
It's a well constructed song.
I'm really excited about this. The conversation is really, really thoughtful, and these people. How can we say enough about the amount of time that they spend with us? We are not that interesting. I mean, our questions are just dumb guys asking ridiculous, hey, how'd you book this?
Yeah,
but yet they spend so much time with us. It's really remarkable.
It is remarkable, and you know, they just said, yeah, we'd be happy to do it. And they made it work and gave up so much time. I mean, these are busy people.
Yeah, very busy.
We're going to, a couple of things that, and we'll recap it after we listen, but, you know, to hear Steve and Brian a couple of weeks ago say how focused they are when they book an act. They already know where and when and that. And then to hear Sophie say, "Nah, I kind of I gotta take what they hand me and make
you'll,
it work."
You'll understand that here in a second. But first, let's thank some Patreons. By the way, the Patreons so supportive, so amazing. Jason Hazelbaker, Chloe Howell, Lucy Young, Phil Hanley, Dan Sweeney, Dustin Gehrig, Chelsea Davis, Frank Swanson, Linda Doles, David Grimes, Leslie Condor, and that ever so evasive Ella. More Patreons to thank here in a second. But let's get into it with Sophie and Bobby from C3, who curate parts of your Bonnaroo experience on the What Podcast.
Amazing, hello. Amazing.
Look at this group. What is a fine group that we've assembled this afternoon? How's this? How's this happening?
I'll take it.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you guys so much for doing this.
Absolutely.
Of course.
I think I'm as excited about this one as I am any of them. Brad.
Well, you are our resident EDM guy. That's so right. Of all the people that was into EDM music, it'd be Barry Corder.
You guys, you can't see me from where you are, but just looking at me just screams EDM.
The whole story,
just screams EDM.
Yeah, sure it does.
Well, good. I think we're in good company then.
And Sophie, you're here to talk to us about the experiences out in the plaza. So,
yeah,
Sophie, you do. When did you start doing the plaza work? Because you know these are relatively new, but I'm sure they've been long into planning stages for years, haven't they?
Yes and no. I think we came in a little late, so I'm actually used to be one of the talent buyers on the festival when C3 got involved, and then while I was doing that, they kind of tried to do some stuff out in the campgrounds, and kind of came to us and were like, can you find artists that will play out there, which kind of then segued into this new role I have. But the plazas probably really kind of became what they are in their entirety last year. The year before that, we kind of just built the structures and we're trying to figure out what's what. And then last year, we kind of brought in individual producers and a lot more programming than we've had before.
I have a feeling we're going to jump all over the place with you guys, but in talking with Steve and Brian a couple of 3 weeks ago about how they booked the entire festival, for you guys, mm-hmm. you both sort of come in midstream or downstream, I guess. I mean, everything was well going, but was there sort of a sense of you can do whatever you wanted to do, or was it more of a hard sell type of thing, I guess.
In terms of the plaza specifically?
Yeah, you said reaching out to people and trying to tell them what you wanted to do. Had the festival, did it have enough cachet, I guess, that it was a pretty easy sell, or was it a hard sell?
I mean, yeah, it was definitely a pretty easy sell in the sense that I would say that Bonnaroo is probably a little late into activating the campgrounds. It just wasn't something that they'd ever done before. Obviously, festivals in Europe and a couple of others over here that have, camping, a huge camping aspect, definitely, try and activate out there. And I think it just took us a while to kind of figure out how to do that. And obviously, Bonnaroo is so huge. So making sure that we can really tailor to, our audience and that we hit kind of each group. So it's easy in that sense. What's difficult is trying to, I think, get people to understand this new way of programming and activations and how it works out there that's different from the standard kind of center route structure that they are aware of. And also for us, we have a huge audience, so trying to figure out how much programming we can have and that we have enough, but then making sure that what we have doesn't clash and that it kind of curtails to what everyone else wants to do out there, which is obviously everything and anything. So,
and to double back on what Barry was asking, do they give you sort of like an outline as to what they're going for, and you sort of have to fit make those ideas happen, or do you get pretty much free rein on over the whole thing?
It's a little bit of both. So I'm still on the booking team, so I'm still fully in the loop with the lineup and what everyone's doing. And so as and when we can plug and play from the lineup, we do that. But in terms of what we do out there, as long as I'm not doing anything that's offensive. I can do pretty much do whatever I want.
Where's that line?
No kidding.
I mean, right? So, I mean, we're super lucky with Bonnaroo that it's a very free and open festival, which is really exciting for us because it means that we kind of, you know, have an audience that is open to a lot of different things. And so that's great for us. But it's obviously, you know, huge. So we have to figure out, rein that in. And so I can't go too crazy. So it's figuring out kind of how we do that. And that, you know, people that want to sleep, we make sure that we're not offending them by having anything too late. But then the people that want to still stay up, that we can figure out that part too. So it's a lot of different aspects.
And for anybody that hasn't ever been to Bonnaroo, the thing that is remarkable is a couple of years ago, 5 years ago or so, these things didn't exist. So now you have something to do pretty much all day and all night, and it becomes in and of itself its own festival, its own individual thing, which I gotta imagine can end up getting a little pricey. At what point do you start saying, we're just out of money?
We've given you enough. Go ahead,
at the beginning.
That's me.
About 6 months ago.
Exactly.
Because you guys really spare no expense. And the reason I ask that, like, you go to the House of Love, right? A couple of years ago. The place has done phenomenally well. You guys do not, it doesn't feel like you miss a detail. And it, what I've always loved about Bonnaroo is that when you go to the user experience inside the festival, you can't really find a place where they've missed a tiny detail. And you guys really pay attention to those outside into the festival grounds or into the campgrounds. And I got to imagine at some point you're like, well, how can we just do this for free, right? How can we just arts and crafts our way to making this work? And that, to me, requires an amount of energy, bodies, human beings, hands, creativity that, you know, can't all be done with, you know, just, you know, three or four people, right?
So, I mean, totally. It's definitely a heavy lift. We're very lucky that the Palombine team, including Bobby, has some really, really awesome relationships. And so it's a balance, right? Like, obviously, we have a budget, but then we have a huge plethora of artists that are already playing the festival that hopefully, because Bonnaroo is a little out of the way, a lot of them are sticking around for the weekend and see these opportunities as something exciting and different and a great marketing moment for them. And so it's a little bit of both. It's working with Bobby and their team to figure out how we can use their relationships and people, you know, artists on site that are reaching out to them that might want to do something different or are like, hey, we're going to be there all weekend. Is there a way to get a little bit of extra cash? And then obviously some of it is just kind of going for the big ones and just seeing if we can figure out a way to get them to understand what it is and do something different than what they're normally used to doing.
I want to come back, Sophie, to the plazas and all of that, but I want to ask Bob some of the same questions. Is it Bobby or Bobby? Which do you prefer?
Oh, either one's fine. Bobby's fine.
Okay, you got it, Robert.
I want to ask this sort of the same question because I think these two things, the events, the experiences in the plazas and the other stage and the EDM, are two of the bigger changes that we've seen in the last 4, 5, 6 years.
It's really thrown a breath of fresh air into the whole festival.
Made a huge
right?
difference, and that's what I want to come back to. But I want to, like, let's get caught up with Bobby and the EDM stages. What was your charge? What was the mission that they said, go do this and do it, well, for, like Brad said, for free? No, I'm sure they didn't.
You know, it's interesting because some of the most legendary and most talked about sets out of Bonnaroo in the last 10 years have been those from the electronic acts, you know, Pretty Lights, you know, until 6 in the morning, Deadmau5 Late Night, Basslechter Late Night. You know, some of those sets are categorized as the most legendary performances of the history of Bonnaroo. So it was only natural to kind of give that space its own area within Cineroo. And the first 3 years of booking this stage, it was very much an experiment, trying to figure out what the Bonnaroo audience was interested in. And we didn't want to just assume that everyone liked the same thing. So we booked a little bit of everything. You know, we booked the first year probably, you know, an act out of every single subgenre that we possibly could to take, you know, take the crowd's temperature. But this year, I feel like we really zeroed in, and it takes a lot of communication and working in tandem with Brian and Stephen and Sophie to really present a coherent offering. You know, we can't do what we do without communication. So, you know, I need to know what's going on the other side of the park just as much as Brian and Steve need to know what's going on with the other stage. So it's all one unit moving towards the same goal. So I'm not over there just booking on an island. We're all communicating. Okay, this act is playing at 7 o'clock. What would be a nice counter program to that? Okay, let's book that over here. You know, so we're constantly working together to try to present a really unique experience day to day out there.
You said that, it said something interesting just now, that you, the first year that you just sort of like were experimenting and taking the temperature of the audience. What did you learn that first year?
I learned that it's nice to try to check as many boxes as you possibly can, but it's also it's hard to gather information that way. And, you know, we
in what
booked,
way? Say when you say gather information, what information are you looking to gather?
You know, trying to create a vibe that grows throughout the day, right? And not trying to have or try to produce the same amount of energy at 4 o'clock that you would at midnight. So trying to create a gradual build into energy and stage performance to where it culminates to an apex at the end of the night, right? Because we all know it can be excruciatingly hot out there. So trying to expect a 4 o'clock crowd to have the same energy as the 11 o'clock crowd is difficult to do. So these days we're trying to produce a more gradual build to the end of the night, instead of having everyone that could be deemed, you know, super high energy in their respective subgenre of electronic music playing, you know, every set of the day. So right now we're just taking a little bit more caution and a little bit more time and curation into booking the other stage versus figuring, you know, go grab everyone that we possibly can and let's see what works. So right now we're really trying to curate the experience over there. And especially now that we're going later. And, you know, as you mentioned earlier, Bonnaroo is now on what feels like a 20-hour programming schedule. You know, so we're taking all that into effect, or all that into account, rather.
Well, I think that's, I mean, Brad and I, we were joking when we first came on about, you know, me being maybe the EDM guy and him not. I have a few that I like. I like Bass Nectar. I like Girl Talk quite a bit. I like it, fair to say, more than you, Brad. Is that?
Yeah, the word would be fair.
That's fair.
Yes.
and so to hear you say that, I can already hear in Brad's head, what do you mean subgenres? What do you mean? It's
I was not going to ask that, but I've been thinking it the entire time.
Sure.
I didn't want to sound like a fool.
Sure. And I was listening earlier this morning to some of the bands on the lineup, and I learned a new phrase, future bass. I'd never heard that before.
Right.
That's a new genre that Flume help pioneer, Brad. See, it's why we're here.
Right. You are, no kidding.
Flume helped pioneer that, so it doesn't have that bass drop that
exactly.
Most of us think of. It's more subtle. And in fact, a lot of the bands or acts that I was listening to, Glass Animals, Seven Lions, Rez, sort of have that more. And I didn't, you know, I haven't listened to their whole catalog, and so I don't even mean to pretend to be now an expert on it, but I was surprised at where EDM is now versus 5-6 years ago when I first started hearing it.
Of course. And, you know, Brad, I think a way to comprehend it better, and, you know, if future bass isn't really digesting, is consider it like mid-tempo, right? So there's a big moment right now where a lot of these mid-tempo acts that like Rez or like a Gustafelstein are making incredible music, and they have their own ravenous fan base. And it's not about, you know, the quote unquote drop, or the huge buildup. It's a gradual build throughout the show. And it's more about a groove, which, you know, I think makes these acts really perfect for the Bonnaroo setting, because Bonnaroo for 19 years now has always been about, you know, setting the groove. So,
and this is me being stupid, but you're going to have to help me determine what the difference is between EDM and, say, house music.
Sure. So right now there's a, or not right now, but in the last decade, there's a term that the media likes to use that has some, stirs up some negative connotation or stigmatizes electronic music. And that term is EDM. House music has been around since the 80s. You know, I mean, it's from Detroit in the late 80s, early 90s.
Even LCD Sound System would classify themselves as a house music band sometimes.
I think that they have house music influences, sure. Right? But at the end of the day, they're a rock band, right? Yeah. I mean,
well, you got 11 like people on stage. I can imagine.
I mean, James Murphy has a great side DJ business. Like, it's like he puts on a hell of a DJ set, and it's 99% house music, and it's a lot of fun. But you know, there is a, going back to what you were asking. I mean, EDM is kind of a catch-all, right? It's like saying rock music, but there's a lot of different kind of rock music, right?
Yeah, that's a good point.
So there, you know, between future bass and deep house and dubstep and trap music and techno, you know, there's so many little avenues or little carve outs that people tend to identify with more than others. You know, so the EDM term is kind of a catch all, right?
Sure.
And you hear that term and it conjures up certain images in your head, right?
Me saying it just makes me feel like a dad. You know, I don't necessarily feel comfortable even saying it because I don't know what I'm talking about.
Next, you'll be saying things like hip.
Yeah, these kids. These kids are in their hip. Their hip bass
that's
music.
Right, that's right.
As soon as you say it, it's done.
So when you go to have a headliner for Insert Night here on the other. Now tent, right? And so you have
not a tent, it's a full-blown outdoor stage.
Sure.
Now.
Yeah. So
yeah,
so you go from you know, a tempo that is a little bit more light in the midday, it starts to build a groove, and then the big the big blowout at the end of the night. At what point do you get like a headliner and you say, you know what, this is going to work better on the what? This is just too big, or The Witch, or somewhere else in the festival.
Well, trust me, that happens, you know, frequently. It's tough when you're talking to specific acts that are worth, you know, 20,000-30,000 tickets in the region, right? Like, they don't want to play something that is called the dance stage, right? I mean, that's kind of... it's kind of pigeonholing, and it's not marginalizing, but it's kind of putting them in a box, right? And they want to be where the other guys that are selling big tickets in the region are playing, and typically that's the what. I mean, look, we've gotten really lucky over at the other stage over the years. Like, our first year, we had Marshmello headlining, which now Marshmello is one of the biggest acts in the world, right? But Bass Nectar, you know, he couldn't come and play for over there at the other stage because it's just too big. His show is too big. You know, there'd be 40,000 people over there, and it would be absolute, you know, bedlam over there. So really, we're trying to program an experience over there that is just right for that space, that takes into account what's going on around us, that takes into account, you know, being in a little nook over there, and we've got the Oasis right next to us. So we're programming stuff in our area over there that really helps create our own little identity within Centaroo, right? So it would be nice to get, you know, an act, I guess, you know, something along the sides of Bass Nectar over there. But at the same time, we're a little different over there, and it's kind of an area for people that want to keep that little area special, right? So it's really a unique experience within an experience.
That leads to my question, and from your research and from your intent, do you think or expect people to stay there all day? Or do you?
I mean, well, it's happened. Yeah. Well, the last few years, we've absolutely had some people that stay from 3 till 3, right?
That's got to be really hard to curate, going back to what you were talking about. I mean, you can't.
It is.
A human being can't be base nectar 20 hours a day. Your head would explode.
Yeah. That would be like if I just sat there and listened to the Warren Treaty for 12 hours. I don't have tears left. I don't.
Exactly. Yeah. I cry no more. No, I can't snap my head anymore. Yeah, I mean, base nectar, those guys have to curate their own shows, you know. They don't come out and, for the most part, do 90 minutes of just bass drop. So,
no,
that's got to be
tough. I mean, base nectar's a rare bird, right? I mean, he's got the music, he's got the show.
Yeah.
And look, he's one of the few guys in the electronic space that there's actually a message at the show, right?
Right, and that's the part of what I like Girl Talk as well. It's not right. just stringing together clip after clip, you know.
And it's not just about lights, and it's not just about laser and production. Like, there's actually a message, you know, being put in front of you.
Right.
And what you choose to do with that message is up to you. But you know, I love Bass Nectar very much. I do too.
I tell this story all the time. When he was there, 6, 7, 8 years ago, the guy that was camping next to me was a musician. And when Bass Nectar stopped, he came running back to the camping area in near tears, calling his girlfriend to please come get him because his heart was going to explode.
How's he doing today?
I don't know what kind of self-medication he was also doing, but he was literally, my heart is going to explode.
That message got into him.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Bobby, but I always have to tell that because it was so funny.
How in the world did you get into EDM? I did it again. How did you get into electronic music to begin with? What was the artist? Well, what was the one that turned it for you?
Well, it's funny. My family owned the only techno and hip-hop record store in Dallas for a number of years. And growing up in Dallas, I worked at that store in the summer, and I became very familiar with a lot of techno acts. And my cousin was a DJ. And
like who? Give me somebody that you were listening to then.
Oh gosh, this was 1996.
Yeah.
Kevin Sutherland from Detroit. It was so long ago. Hive, you know, there's a lot of guys that aren't around. A guy named at the time Eric Entity, who is from Dallas, who turned out who ended up being one of the biggest and still is one of the biggest techno DJs in the world. He goes by Maceo Plex. But he worked in our family's record store. So I was always surrounded with it, which is very funny because our family is very old Texas kind of, you know, country people, but for some reason techno was always kind of a part of our family. It's very interesting.
The reason I ask is because if you're somebody that really is into it, you had your own record store. That's unbelievable. In 1996, it was that big of a deal that people were going to buy, you know, it on vinyl, and it was sustaining a business, which is, I mean, that's pretty impressive. But it's never been something that, you know, I usually put on while I'm making a pasta or some bedtime or bath time music. Honey,
it's great.
I can't wait to romance you tonight.
It's good for doing the dishes and vacuuming. Trust me.
Just seems like such a strange thing just to like stumble upon without having like a moment that you can remember. I mean, look, I tie everything. I've been reading this book from Bob Boylan. It's an older book, and it's the song that changed your life, right? So they ask all these other artists, like, what's the song that changed you and made you the artist that you're today? And I guess that even goes for people like us who are really into this.
Sure.
I mean, the one that got me is Dreams to Remember by Otis Redding. It's the greatest piece of art I've ever listened to in my life, and it's the reason why.
Bring me to tears every time.
Yeah, it's the reason why I'm a soul music fan. It's the reason why I like the Alabama Shakes. It's the reason why I like everything that I like today. It all starts from, I've got Dreams to Remember by Otis Redding, and I got him, not knowing the catalogs of, say, any of these electronic acts, I got to imagine you had something that probably flipped a switch on in you at some point.
Not really at that age. You know, at that age, it's all osmosis, right? So, like, you're carrying crates of records for your cousin. You are, you know, kind of sitting Indian style on the floor while he's making mixtapes in the back room. You know, you just kind of get engulfed with the feeling and the overall excitement around the music. And it wasn't until 2003 when, you know, my love for electronic music kind of was rediscovered. And that was very much with early Bass Nectar and Soundtribe Sector 9. And then from there, it just kind of skyrocketed. And so between 1996 and 97, I took a hiatus from it. You know, you're in high school, you're moving around, you kind of latch on to different things. But yeah, around 18 is when it kind of came back into my life. And then 20 is when it became something of a career, when I started throwing shows in Austin and Dallas. And,
fascinating.
Yeah.
Who drove the train to get electronic music at this level at Bonnaroo? Was it AC, Superfly, C3, you guys? I mean, who was the first to raise their hand?
Yeah. I think it was everybody. I think everyone just kind of realized that there is a real need for it on the farm, you know. And I mean, look, let's be really honest. Electronic music now is preaching a lot of the same or carries a lot of the same ethos and belief structures that kind of brought Bonnaroo together all those years ago, 19 years ago. I mean, at the core, electronic music is really just about unity and love and community, and that's all that Bonnaroo was founded on, right? So it's just a different generation telling the same story. It may sound different, it may look different, but the core values are still there. So having a stage dedicated to it and servicing these fans that we want to introduce Bonnaroo to, it was only natural, and no one really had to think twice about it. And now I feel like we're finally at our groove over there, and we're programming it how we like it best, and we're making improvements, and you know, I'm really excited for this year.
Oh, more with Sophie and Bobby from C3, who curate your Bonnaroo experience here in a second. First off, thank you to Bill, Ryan Mathewson, Sean McCarthy, William Witholt, Parker Reed, Meredith Rittman, William Richards, Ross McNamara, Evan Brown, Aaron Carlson, Timothy Proctor, some of our Patreons that we appreciate their support. This is pretty fascinating because, you know, I can find certain things that, you know, I can talk to pretty much anybody about. I just like hearing how you get into it. I like hearing how you just get started and what spins you around and gets you thinking and turns you into a different consumer.
I would not have guessed that there is an electronics dance music
store
in Dallas.
I did not see that coming.
Much less that I would ever talk to somebody whose family
owned it. Yeah. I really, really did want to ask him, usually, is that business still open?
Usually it's, we have that in the back behind the Willie Nelson albums. It's tucked in there.
But would you like to buy some tires first?
We have a whole store of just very, stuff.
I did not see that coming, and I don't want to, you know, behoove anybody from opening a business, but in the mid-90s, opening a techno and dance record store.
Yeah, I don't mean to belittle at all.
I mean, neither.
I would have never guessed.
I know. I'm actually, I'm not just surprised. I'm embarrassed. I didn't think of it. It's a phenomenal idea. This is what I want to do. I want to open up a restaurant that does nothing but chips and dip.
Yeah.
Different types of dip, different types of chips. I make a chip and dip restaurant. If a techno and electronic record store can work, my chip and dip restaurant can work.
I like it, but are you going to open more than one day a week or a year? Just Super Bowl?
Just Super Bowl
College
day.
Bowl?
Yeah, that's right. More Patreons. Melanie and Jesse Feldman, Haley, Nick Eatman, Lauren Edholm, Joshua Herndon, Brooke Tussey, David Solano, David Henson. Recapping here in a second, but more with Sophie and Bobby from C3 now.
It makes sense now, you know, looking back, but it seemed to us anyway, as 15, 16-year veterans, that it was a bold move. You know, you had the year where the numbers were not good, and then you guys come back with electronic music and shift that around, and, you know, the numbers go back up, and it seems like its own thing, and a certain segment love it, and it does fit in with the festival. And I'm glad to hear you say that about it. It has the same sort of thing as rock and roll, because one of the guys who's even a little bit older than me, you know, doesn't get it. He was like, does it have a beginning, a middle, and an end? And what is it? You know? And I said, look, it's just kids, you know, trying to do the same thing you were in the 60s and 70s. And your parents
absolutely
hate it. Your parents hate it, which makes it even more appealing. And he was like, okay, I get that, you know.
And look, I'm telling you, it's this community is no different. They look out for each other. They care about each other. They preach love. You know, it's a community that I'm proud to represent to the best of my ability. So
yeah,
I'm very pleased with where we are with electronic music at Bonnaroo. And I think it's only going to get better.
I want to get Sophie back. I'm going to tell another quick, funny story. That same guy, though, we were standing there watching, I don't even know who it was, at 2 a.m. just to check it out, seeing the kids in their rabbit costumes and they're dancing and having a great, and they kept looking over their shoulder at us. And for a brief minute, I thought, wow, they think we're cool. And then I thought, no, they think we're narcs.
It wasn't a thought. No. They weren't thinking.
It was
That's exactly what they knew.
It was fun to
watch. They were right. You were a narc. You were looking, you were digging through their pockets.
So, Sophie, going back to what I said earlier, and I'm in it, I really think, I mean, when Brad and I started doing this podcast, the reason was we looked at that lineup 3 years ago and didn't know 70% of the acts and thought maybe other people are the same. And it's become a whole thing. We've done, I mean, almost year round with the podcast. And the experiences in the plazas and the electronic dance music are two of the biggest reasons. I mean, it's interesting to hear you say it took them a long time to come around finally to dealing with the camping. But I think that's been a huge shift forward.
What took them so long? Did they need the infrastructure first? Did they need the showers and the bathrooms to be on site first? And what was it? What was the catalyst?
It was a little of everything. It was, you know, you're building a world out there, right? So it adds a huge expense onto the festival budget because, you know, you're supplying power and tents and infrastructure. And it's just, getting their heads around that when the festival had, you know, sold out for so many years just based on the lineup, I think was just one thing to get their heads around. But I think it was just, you know, just adapting with the times. It's just now when you go to a festival, even just a city festival, you know, there is so much more going on than just just the bands on the stages like it used to be. And I think it's just kind of understanding that and adapting with the times and knowing that we kind of have to provide this 360 experience for the fans if we kind of really want to keep up with the market. And so I think it was just figuring out how best to do that and how we do that within budget, which took a while. And that's kind of where the plaza concept.
Well, speaking of the budget, when you go to have the budget, does that come from somewhere else or is it just a brand new budget that's created for the plazas? Like, for instance, you'll get a lot of people, the skeptics or the questioners asking, am I losing a headliner to make the plaza experiences better? Are they taking, you know, something and from one budget and giving it to you for the plazas, or is it a completely different entity?
No, we're not losing anything by this kind of new world being created. The entire purpose of it was to kind of create a new experience and an addition to what's already on site at the festival. And so this is just kind of a new concept and a new way of programming. And the entire idea is to not kind of take away from the fans' experiences, to add to it.
And you said that it's happening overseas and in British festivals or England. I can't remember exactly what you said. Is there's no one in the US, in the States, doing this kind of plaza experience in their camping festival, are they?
No, there's no one in the US. It's just a different history, right? Like European festivals historically, because of location and just kind of what they're used to, have notoriously been camping festivals. Is kind of what they've done for the last 50 years in terms of their location and site. There's actually very few city festivals over there, and so they've just been doing it a lot longer, and so, you know, you have festivals like Glastonbury, for example, and Bestival and the Isle of Wight, where the sites are so huge that's kind of what they've been doing. But no one's doing the plaza concept per se, but everyone is kind of doing a different take on providing you know different experiential programming to fans.
You just gave me what are the main differences between, say, a Glastonbury or a festival overseas as to, you know, versus main festivals here in the States? What are the main differences between the two?
I mean, that's a really big question, right? Because yeah. they all
well, it just hit me. I was like, oh my god, that's right. There's there's thousands of other music festivals. I wonder, like, it didn't even occur to me that most English festivals were camping festivals until you literally just said it.
Well, just mm-hmm. to jump in.
I mean, they're all kind of uniquely different in their own way. You know, so, they're the same way that we have. Some of them, you know, EDM leaning. Some of them are hip hop leaning. Some of them are multi genre, sure. like Bonnaroo. Glastonbury, as an example, I would say sonically is very similar to Bonnaroo in mm-hmm. terms of, you know, it's a huge tier one multi-genre festival. It has some very large stages, has some very small stages. Their site is ginormous, and so they kind of do a lot of different things. I would also say that audience is a little older leaning, and so they kind of can do a lot more, what is the word I'm looking for, risky things in terms of some of their programming. But they're similar in lots of ways, and they're different in lots of ways. It's just a different demographic and, you know, different locations. So you're kind of tailoring to a different audience.
That was one of the questions I had for Ashley Capps probably about year three or four, was who he modeled Bonnaroo after.
Bonnaroo.
We had this discussion last episode, how to say it. Because I was impressed with the organization of it. I always sort of figured Disney was somewhat of a model because Disney is very well organized in the Masters golf tournament.
Never miss a touch. Yeah, never miss a detail.
Beautiful what they do. But he said, no, it was the European festivals, like Glastonbury in particular, that they were modeling after. So, Sophie, same sort of question for you that I asked Bobby about the EDM crowd. We have marveled and said for many, many years that there was no reason for us to go out into general camping.
We nicknamed it, very unfortunately, years ago, the Savages.
it was pretty rough.
In gen pop out there, but now I'm very jealous of their campsites because they're better than mine.
Yeah, and the work you've been doing, we're like, wow, that's I could almost see never really leaving.
I know.
You know, just staying there and checking things out. So,
especially if you all of a sudden get a Cage the Elephant secret show popping up every now and then, yeah, why would you?
Yeah, is that something, do you find that there are people now that are doing that, Sophie, that they're just sort of, we're hearing from a lot more people who say, you know, the lineup isn't really that important. I go for my friends and the camping and the whole community experience. And what you have done out there in particular is a big part of that. Does it feel like it's shifting how people spend their day quite a bit?
I think it totally is. I mean, last year, as an example, you know, we definitely had our program was kind of 110% more, you know, at a full capacity than it was the year before. You know, we shut down for the headliners in the same way that that Senaru does, out of respect, and also because we know that's where everyone, you know, wants to be. But I think there's just a lot more to do, right? Like, we have We're in the Woods that kind of ran really late last year and kind of took over for that Sunrise programming, and it was the first time that we've kind of ever had that. So I think there's definitely a lot more to do and a lot of more individual experiences, so fans are kind of realizing that and tailoring their schedule accordingly.
So, speaking of We're in the Woods, what's different about We're in the Woods this year?
You'll have to see. We're not announcing any
of that. That's where I was going with this, because are you set by now, or are you still tinkering with programming?
We still have a long way to go. The schedule is normally announced around April. And so that's kind of where you'll see the big schedule lineup, but we have a couple of We're in the Woods announces.
Okay, well, walk me through that process of how you put together the festival, the campground experiences, the plaza experiences. Do you wait till the lineup is pretty much set with the booking department, or are you is there one thing that you start with? Is there some things that you try to get out in front of? Do you try to get done with a few things so that you can finish up at the last minute? I don't even know where to start, how to eat this elephant.
Totally. I mean, it's all, excuse my language, a shit show work in progress. there isn't a specific, you know, it's not like I wish I could say that I start at the beginning of the year, and that, you know, obviously we work alongside the booking team, and I wish that I could kind of say that that's as straightforward as it goes. Obviously, as artists go, they sometimes want to confirm in January, sometimes they want to confirm the day before the festival. And so it's kind of making sure that we have enough around it so that we're not relying fully on that But it's a little bit of both. Sorry, that's not a great answer to the question. It kind of just flows, and we pick deadlines for each area, and then I kind of just go for it. And a lot of the time, we'll, with the help of Bobby, we'll kind of announce surprise performances.
You have 200 balls in the air at one time.
I was going to say, it sounds a little bit like the answer we got from those guys 3 weeks ago about how they booked the Super Jams. You know, they have an idea in mind. This person or these people might be good, but then somebody else who's on the lineup or who did it years before or the year before says, I'd like to be involved in that. And so that's while you were saying all that, I was thinking about what Steve Green told us, that he hears a band and pictures automatically what stage, what time of day, and which day, which sounds like you don't have that luxury.
Yeah, it's pretty much like that. You know, we have the same for Bobby, but we have, you know, a schedule, which is a little crazy. It's almost 4.5 days to kind of program. And it's a lot of chicken and egg of trying to figure out, you know, who's ready to confirm and then who isn't. And also like where you'd like to have things when. And so it's definitely.
Is there a plaza right now that doesn't even have a concept?
No.
Okay. No. So at least conceptually, so that's something that you can check off the list, right? So if you do a checklist and you've got all these boxes, you can at least check, well, I've got that concept down. Now do I got to figure out what makes sense in this concept, right?
Yeah.
When are the concepts of the campgrounds set in stone? When have you figured out what you want it to look like?
Probably. I mean, we try and have them figured out before the lineup announces. Like, as everyone's booking, that's when we'll kind of try and figure out, because we'll know how, like, you know, which artists want to be involved and stuff. So I would say probably, you know, by December, I'll have the producers and each plaza figured out in terms of theme.
And how many people do you have working each plaza as, like, producers and designers, et cetera?
So we had, like, just as a statistic, I think last year we had 730 people out in the campgrounds in terms of just for the plazas. And that's just staffing. That's not fans. Yeah.
Yeah. What was the number you were going to guess?
I was going to say five or six. I was going to say 5 or 6. As a guy who has a staff of like 3 or 4 radio stations. No, I was going to say 5 or 6. Yeah, that is unbelievable. So, by the time the lineup drops, you've got conceptually what you want to do. And I'm guessing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but inside the contracts of some of the artists, you can say, well, they're willing to do something. We just need to figure out what it is later. Or are they already saying, no, we want to do specific things at a specific time?
It's completely both.
Okay.
Not necessarily with time schedule, that we, you know, they normally kind of let me figure that out, but a lot of them come in with ideas that they have. A lot of them come in programming, like, you know, House of Yes is kind of self-sufficient. They kind of come in and program the entire thing themselves, which is glorious. And then a lot of the time it's kind of it's like a chicken and egg of, you know, they want certain artists to play, or they have a concept in mind, and then I kind of go out and try and figure out if I can make that happen.
And do you have like a mission statement where you basically say the weirder the better? I bet there's no rules for what you have available to you.
Yes and no. It kind of just depends on the area and what we're trying to do there.
Okay.
So, sorry, there's no straight answer for that. But there's some areas, right? Like, you know, Hayley Williams, it's supposed to be about love and wellness and mental health. You know, there's obviously guidelines alongside that. House of Yes. Wild and crazy, and so there's, you know, they're a little more open. It just kind of depends on each one.
How many people do you have right now just batting around ideas for each, like, what's your staff like? What is your group look like when you go to have a meeting or a conference call? How many people are you talking to about curating in each individual experience?
So it's a great, in terms of my, in terms of my internal team, as in just on the plaza team, I have two others that kind of help me manage everything. I'm just going to put this on. And then in terms of, you know, the bigger C3 team, I mean, Bob, I have no idea, 50 of us from C3.
sounds about right.
Yeah.
Five or six.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
That is fascinating. I mean, because you have to, like, this is what's so crazy about this is, like, we get so lost in worrying about the details of a lineup or details of the user experience inside the festival. It sounds to me like you want to, I hope to, maybe I'm assuming a little bit too much. They have gotten to a point, you know, Steve and Brian have gotten to a point where they know how this is all going to essentially go. They've been doing it for so long that the setup is pretty much baked into the cake at this point. You sound as if it's still such a baby and it's still such a fledgling operation and a growing operation that you still don't have a structure around it. I'm wondering is, like, do you see, when you look 5 years down the road, do you see a much better structure, or do you foresee it sort of still operating like this?
I mean, I think it's already a great structure. You know, it's kind of what we're used to. The entire nature of our business is kind of, you know, going with the flow to an extent and, to, you know, taking the punches as they come and coming up with ideas and seeing how we can execute them. So it's just a structure that's innate to our business because we have to just kind of be ready for changes and for things to happen that are either out of our control or stuff that we're trying to produce.
Yeah.
I think it's fascinating to hear from you guys confirm exactly what Steve and Brian and Ted said, how important all that communication between all the different departments are, how, you know, the ticket or the lineup for the main, the what stage has to match somewhat the other. And
right.
The whole thing is curated to blend.
Right.
I just don't think people who haven't seen it or can't see it from, you know, sort of the 100-mile view
sure.
can figure out how that works. I mean, it's huge. 90 to 100 acts, 80,000 people on the farm. That's a lot of moving parts.
No kidding. Hey, real quick, and you can answer this for me, Bobby. Clarify for me how you say the stage that no longer exists at Bonnaroo. I'm not saying it. I'm not going to say it. But it exists right there where the comedy tent used to be.
Oh.
Yeah, starts with a K.
Calliope.
Attaboy.
Okay. There it so is. This is what's frustrating about this is I hear all of you say this, but if you go to New Orleans, none of them say Calliope. They say Calliope.
What do they know?
So I fight everybody at camp about this every year. Calliope is not how they say it down there, and I think that it's born from the Creole language, is it not?
I believe it is, and I've heard it Calliope, yeah. Calliope, Calliope. I mean, I've heard just about every iteration of it, too. But,
okay.
I go with Manfred Mann.
And is it for sure not returning this year?
Yeah, from what we understand, you know, I think it's still up in the air a little bit. You know, it's a really fun experience. You know, if it does not return, make no mistake, Bonnaroo will be providing an experience of equal or greater value. So while I can't speak to the finality of its return or not, you know, I can say that it's a wonderful experience hanging, you know, with all the Calliope guys and for the fans being out there till 6 a.m. while that thing is shooting fire and
right. But that's not something that you actually booked. That was another company that did that, right?
Well, we booked it the last few years.
Oh, okay.
And we booked it in tandem with the other stage. So we'd work closely with the guys at Walter and kind of let them know, hey, this guy wants to stick around a little bit later. Let's see if he can come and play for you guys. This guy is flying out at 8 a.m. So he wants to DJ until the sun come up, which was very much the case with Cascade a number of years ago. Hmm. You know, Cascade is a massive name internationally. Right. And he just wanted to play all the songs that he can't typically play in his set, you know, songs he hasn't played in 15 years or so. And he said, I'll play as long as you let me, you know,
wow.
which is pretty rare these days.
That's
he wanted
cool.
to play while the sun was coming up. He wanted to, you know, to not announce it. He wanted to keep it very special. And, you know, there's been a lot of memorable, iconic moments rather between, you know, Bonnaroo and Calliope.
Let's get into the lineup a little bit. Who are the acts that you're especially looking forward to see over there on the other?
You know, I got to say, I really love this year's lineup, you know, as I have in years past. But I think this year's lineup in particular kind of speaks a bit more to my tastes. You know, on Thursday night, I absolutely love Davin, who also happens to be the guitar player in Illenium's band. And I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with Illenium, but he's had an absolute massive last year playing arenas. And I think he just did over 35,000 tickets in San Francisco. And his guitar player has an epic project called Dabin. And it's really beautiful, melodic music. That's on Thursday night, closing the other stage. Really looking forward to Tipper. Tipper's on Friday, and I tell you what, Tipper has a very unique history. Tipper has been a DJ for 25 years, and a lot of people, including Bass Nectar, have gained some influence from him over the years. And he makes really out there, super psychedelic music, and it's one of the best shows out there. I mean, they take great pride in their visual presentation, and they spend a lot of time on the audio. They want the audio to be just right. They're very particular about their show, and it really shows. Subtronics we're really excited about. Rez we're really excited about. Peekaboo. It's just going to be a really great year over there, and I think it's going to be a blast, and I hope to see you guys over there.
Yeah, I mean, you guys, look, it's the other fits a very important part of the landscape, right? And so does electronic music, because it is damn near everywhere. It's represented so many places around the country and so many other festivals. Do you sometimes do, and I ask the same thing of, the AC guys, do you sometimes see what other festivals are doing, especially with the electronic music, and try and not do that specifically? Or are, other festivals doing it in a way that you want to get to? Or how do you see the landscape when you look at all the other festivals and how much electronic music is actually out there?
Well, it's hard because you don't want every show to look the same, right? So you kind of have to find what makes your show unique and special and program around that and try to shine a light on that. So the way that I book the electronic stage at Bonnaroo is not necessarily the same way I book it in Chicago for Lollapalooza, or the same way that we would book the electronic music at Voodoo in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. I try to look at each show in a vacuum, and I try to treat each show like no other show matters. Right. And try to, for Bonnaroo, for example, like I want to be programming acts that have a fan base that will want to party until 4 or 5 in the morning. I want to program acts that kind of play into the nature and the geography of East Tennessee. I want to be curating it as much as I possibly can with keeping every detail of the show in mind,
Interesting. So if that's a thought for Bonnaroo, what is your thought when you make Perry's when you do Perry's stage in Lollapalooza?
Well, Perry's, it's a non-camping show. It's in an urban setting. It's in the Midwest. So I program that show probably a little bit different. Like I probably couldn't get away with a Tipper in Chicago, right? Huh. I mean, just because Lollapalooza is a bit more of a commercial show. Tipper wouldn't resonate with the Lollapalooza audience as much as he would the Bonnaroo audience, I'd probably, lean more to booking more commercially friendly DJs than I would at Bonnaroo.
Does any of the production ever come into play? Because shout out to my boy Justin Casey, who is one of the damn near the best visual guys on the planet. He does the visuals and the staging for the Perry stage, and to me, it's visually one of the best experiences that you have at Lollapalooza.
Well, I tell you what, Grant Park is one of the most gorgeous festival sites, or parks rather, in the world. So I mean, we have an epic canvas to do in the baseball field. You look to your right and there is the skyline. You look to your left and there's water. I mean, we really have it lucky in Chicago. It's a gorgeous site, and Perry's has its nice little area over there where we're able to kind of do what we want and present just a really outrageous experience with as much video, lights, and audio as we possibly can.
Yeah, but it doesn't change the way that you book it.
Are you asking if if the location of the festival plays into a part of how I book.
The production costs, essentially. Like, does production ever... Oh, does it really?
I mean, look, we want to be programming with or working with acts that have a show, you know? And some acts, it's probably a little bit early to be booking them on a stage like that. But, mm-hmm. I mean, we've done a great job of putting young acts on a very big platform in Chicago. Mm-hmm. You know, so we just let everyone know ahead of time, like, this is what you're performing on. Come with your best, you know, because mm-hmm. these fans expect it, because that's what Lollapalooza is known for, is being a hell of a show, and we want to hold everyone to that same standard.
Is that the same deal with Bonnaroo, the production level?
You know, it's a little bit different. Bonnaroo, it being only a third year stage, right? I mean, we're still growing into our space over there and trying to find what makes us special over there, you know? So we're actually in the midst of making a few production changes for 2020, and even discussing some new and exciting things for the 20th next year. But yeah, we're actively, you know, considering what is in the canon for this year, if you will, whenever we're programming the show.
Does the ability to have an act play at 4 a.m, 5 a.m. on the farm, is it easier or harder? Does it make it easier? Just a finite number of acts.
Seems to me like they already know that that's what their life is anyway. It sounds to me like that's when they usually when they play. Yeah.
Well, look, I think it depends on the act, right? For some, they want to be that guy that is owning the moment at 4 a.m. And then you've got some guys that are like, yeah, like I want to end at 11 or 12, and that's just fine too. Really this year we're kind of, you know, working with guys that are kind of on the come up right now. So those guys want to get out there and they want to play the late night sets and they want to make that connection with their fans, because they want people leaving the show saying, oh my God, did you see so-and-so at 4 o'clock? That was one of the best experiences I've ever had. Because, you know, the nighttime is so important to the other stage, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, that's when our production can really shine. That's kind of when the memories are made for, right. You know, for Bonnaroo, is when the sun goes down.
Well, I just have one final question. I appreciate your time. It's been phenomenal. Thank you so much. Do you have any inclination as to any electronic music being on the what or which stage at all this year?
You know, there may be something. But nothing that I can speak to at this time.
Yeah,
I understand
the trepidation. The reason I ask is when you have an electronic artist, say, you know, a Rez, and you really want to put them on, you know, Late Night Witch, you know, is that something that they're asking you to go do and book, or is it something that they're taking on because it's, you know, not the other?
Well, If it's outside of the other stage, we're having a conversation and I know what's going on, but that's Brian and Steve. Brian and Steve run with all the other stages and I'm overseeing the other. But if it is electronic music, we are in strategy together. It's not just a hey, we're going to put this over here. Let us know what you want to do over there. It's more about, well, what can we do to complete the story of this day? If we put this DJ over here, can we stagger this one over here to where fans can come back to the other stage and finish their night over there? In the situation where there is an electronic act that should go, like maybe it's a full band, maybe this act has, you know, a drummer and it is a 4 or 5 piece band, you know, they would go over to the Witch. But for traditional DJ setups, I'll say, we're trying to present that the best we can to these acts, because, you know, we have all the video, all the lighting, and it's a real party over there.
I should have asked you earlier, do you stay just there or do you go to other shows?
You know, this is a joke because I get poked about this just about every year. Like, you know, I've been working Perry stage at Lollapalooza for coming up on 9 years. And I'll tell you what, I've never seen a show at Lollapalooza outside of the other stage or outside of Perry's. I never leave. If it's my stage, I never leave. I've only left the other stage at Bonnaroo once since we've come on board, and that was to see Bass Nectar.
Wow. Well, I mean, with all you're saying, it does sound very likely that somebody like Flume would be playing after Lizzo on maybe The What or The Witch. Would that be right to assume, maybe?
That would be a fair assumption.
Okay. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Based on everything that, I mean, it makes so much sense what you're saying. And again, I can't say enough about the thank you for your time. This has been fascinating because I've had to dive into something that I don't really understand, but it's something I love so much and the nerd part of it.
Yep.
Even that nerd happens all over the festival. It doesn't, it's not just with the.
That's right.
Well, I'll tell you what, fellas, I went to the first two Bonnaroos when I was 17 years old. I drove up from Central Florida with a buddy, and Bonnaroo absolutely changed my life in every single iota, in every single way possible. So to be on this call with you guys 20 years later, talking about the festival and my role in it is very
surreal.
It's very humbling. Pretty it's surreal. Surreal. Awesome. So
how many did you get to in those last 19 years?
I went to the first two, mm-hmm. and then I've been going the last 3 years.
Okay.
Wow.
Well, what in the hell happened those 12 years in between?
Oh man, just bad. I wish I could give you a good answer, but I don't have one. bouncing around, you know. Just doing what I can, starting a business, joining up with C3, working all those festivals, but I tell you what, I Bonnaroo will always be, always be my first love. So I'm very honored to have spent this time talking about it with you, and I can't wait for this year. It's gonna be an incredible show.
More Patreons to thank: Skyler, Sean McCain, Phil Nye, Justin Negro, Andrew T. McBride, and Mary T. and Barry Corder.
I like
that.
Oh,
wait.
Guy.
No, that last guy was just from the email. Oh, sorry.
I
yeah.
Like him,
I think that a little bit of news. I mean, it was just fascinating conversation about all of this, especially the plazas and how they're not done. And I'm really surprised about that. I don't know what I expected, to be honest with you, but the fact that the plazas won't their ideas won't even come to fruition or to be finalized for, I mean, damn near 2 more months is stunning to me.
Yeah. And you asked Sophie, I think the idea of the weirder the better. I mean, that to me, that would be my opening line. I want you to think of something crazy, stupid, and we'll try to make it work.
Well, yeah.
That's what I would think.
And the fact that her staff now is so little and then on site her staff is so big is mind-blowing to me.
Yeah, those numbers.
By the way, the other thing that, you know, is probably going to, you know, fire a few people up, it's a safe assumption that Flume going to be on the What after Lizzo, I think is a big deal.
And weren't you interested to hear that the idea that they had to start in an unknown place 3 years ago and now they've sort of honed it on down? Again, part of that is because you and I are not electronic dance music experts, so the idea of honing it down is one thing, but they had to sort of throw it out there, throw things at the wall and see what worked and didn't. And
that
then,
is, yes. The first year and how they didn't know. You have to understand, like, the first year of Bonnaroo was exactly the same way.
Yeah.
Let's just see what we can do here and we'll make it work and see if it works. And they're doing that exact same thing in an already pre-established festival in a little nook and seeing what happens, and it's been as successful as it is. It's really fascinating. And now that he's got even some structure in how he's building a groove and building... Right. A sound that then billows by the end of the night was extremely fascinating. I would never have thought about that.
That was interesting, and to hear her say that it probably took Bonnaroo a little longer than it should have to get to this idea of taking care of the campgrounds. But we've talked about that. And you ask, and I don't know that she is necessarily the one to answer because she's new to it, but, yeah, they had to take care of the other infrastructure first and those VIP experiences. Right. So... You know, it's not a blank check.
Such a arduous process. You have to own the farm.
Yeah.
Then you have to run water, spend a ton of infrastructure costs, get the city on board first and foremost. Nothing happens without the approval of, you know, some sort of Manchester City Council.
Without the approval and the cooperation, for sure.
Right. Right. And then you can put in a toilet. I mean, look at all the things that had to go right just to have a toilet.
I say it every year, and it kills me that I even talk about it, but they planted grass. I mean, right. That's a big, big deal on that farm.
I can't get grass in my, you know, backyard that's 10 feet wide. How do they get grass the way that they do is insane.
And that 80,000 people are going to
trample all over
in all sorts of weather for 5 days. So, yeah, it's a huge undertaking, and that's why I think you and I love it and why we talk about it so much.
Well, that's what, it gives us a lot to talk about. Yeah, that's for sure. All right, we'll talk to you next week on the What Podcast. Love you, bye.
Hey. How y'all feeling? Journey through the stories that define the artists playing Bonnaroo. Who are they? What are they? What will you see? The what? Which bands? This year, that matter.
Yay.
With Brad Steiner and Barry Corder.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.